Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mian Team.
With guest co-hosts.
Kamikaze.
Heraclitus.
MMC.
Petrox.
QNL.
Dan, if you're hearing this is because my internet just kind of died on me, and it's coming back to life in just a second.
Welcome to episode 83 of Polycast. I'm Dan Q, and I'm joined by, in alphabetical order by username, Kamikaze.
Hello.
Heraclitus.
Greetings.
MMC.
Hello.
Petrox.
Hi, hi.
QNL.
Hi.
And the Mian Team.
Now hogging Civilization.
Did you practice that?
No, but after our little conversation right before the show, it was too tempting.
Today at Forum Talk, we discussed religion, observations, and reflections. Also, we discussed a new idea for the least favorite civic.
In Research Lab, we talked about siege units as attachments.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
He's basically complaining that there aren't enough effects linked to religion. He's considering the way civs go together that they should get some sort of bonus for it, since civs like Monty often found religion but don't spread it quite as well. So they basically end up wasting text to get religion. Meanwhile, civs like Isabella, they aggressively spread the religion, making them relatively stronger.
The problem I find is if a leader spends time spreading a religion, I often know to hit that leader because they're building missionaries, not units. It makes them vulnerable. If I know automatically a leader's founded a religion, it's like, hit me. It'll just make every leader easy to conquer, and you will reap all the benefits of them founding the religion. It's a bit iffy.
Well, sometimes I like leaving the people who found the religion alone, depending on the AI. Because a lot of the zealots really will leave you alone if you're in their religion. And that essentially gives you a completely backed up front that you can ignore and attack somebody else and know that they won't attack you. You can always come after them later because other than a couple of them, most of the zealots really don't threaten to win the game very much either. They're just kind of placeholders. They take up space from people who can actually win the game. And I find that useful. Now, one of the things that really bothers me about religion in this game, though, and I would like to see some form of change to it in the future, is that too often, based on the spread mechanics, everything turns into one big religious group hug, like, right away. Very frequently, there's two, maybe three religions that are significant in a given game. That's probably the number one cause of runaway situations in the game, or situations where it's almost impossible to win, because there's a religious block that you can't catch. Or you can't really reliably attack without getting them to attack you, or whatever.
I think a good solution to this may be to introduce more religion-based events. I mean, you could have religious uprisings.
Yeah, whatever.
Sorry, I'm anticipating what Phil's going to say, but go ahead.
Well, you could have things like splitting off religions into new religions, into sects and things.
That's not bad.
But wouldn't that basically just introduce more religions to the game? Why not use the existing religions?
Someone founds a religion, then suddenly some of their cities split off into a different religion and they start fighting each other. They become incompatible.
It has happened in history.
Yeah. Having two religions in the same civilization incompatible with each other and then having one split into two incompatible ones would certainly slow people down.
If you do found a lot of religions, he's complaining about the AI doing that, but I do that sometimes. Holy City makes a ton of money. It's so great for commerce, and then your city becomes increasingly tasty treat for Phil, but it's okay. Part of the game.
I kind of disagree on the use of a holy city. There's a big investment for researching a religious tech than in Kotala's and philosophy, that is, because those both unlock, in Kotala's, one of the better building improvements you can have. And then for philosophy, one of the best religious civics available, and it happens to be on the liberalism path. So those two are pretty common to found religions with. But even there, you might not want to actually try to get a great profit as opposed to something else and still spread the religion, as opposed to a different tech that can benefit your empire more directly and sooner. Usually the shrines only become worthwhile if you can get either the AI to build one for you, or you can get a lot of auto-spread in the religion you found, so that you don't have to sink a ton of hammers into missionaries.
Well, it also depends on what kind of win you're going for, because having religions is so advantageous if you're going for a cultural win because of all the cathedrals you can build.
You don't necessarily need to found them to get those, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but having the shrine in one of those three cities definitely helps with the culture.
It's only with four culture, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, with the multipliers, everything means something.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is that I still get them to take advantage of the spread that they do. But they do all the work for me. If I rush them, like, with cats at some point, or not rush, but attack them with cats at some point, they're going to be very easy to conquer because they've spent all their hammers on missionaries, and I just reap all the benefits and then just go off to an easy cultural victory.
It's when you find out that they haven't spent all their hammers on missionaries.
You can look at the power meter.
You got the AP religion and have extra hammers all of a sudden. Uh-oh.
Well, you look at the power meter to know that. If they're severely lagging in the power meter, you give away that they've spent it all on missionaries, especially if that religion's spread considerably. All that information's available to you.
Yeah.
Well,
assuming you've actually spent enough time having met them. When you first meet them, you're, oh, the religion's spread at huge distance, but you can't see the power meter yet.
As soon as you have open borders, you can see a very excellent power meter. And that is, you open borders, run a scout or any other two-move unit through all their cities and just look at what they have. That's consistently effective, and later on you can like base air in their cities and see everything at once, but usually just a couple of units lets you see what their military is and where they're keeping their stacks.
Also, if you've got open borders with them, they're going to be sending missionaries to you as well.
It's always a plus.
I kind of disagree that building lots and lots of missionaries is necessarily a bad strategy for the AI. But basically, all we need to do is change AI so the various AI civs coordinate when attacking someone, or should I say, they should be more aggressive attacking civs of other religions. That basically means that a civ building lots and lots of missionaries would have lots and lots of friends and would get a big share of the spoils in any wars.
I would like to see that.
But that presents the other problem that Philip talked about with a big religious group hug, which is so annoying to break through.
You basically get a religious orgy.
And then whoever isn't in it just gets destroyed.
Yes, that could be a problem, but I think we already talked about the possibility of founding fractions of religions. And I maybe suggested religious events where new or smaller religions suddenly gain popularity and you have an event where you have to choose to adopt the new religion or you get, let's say, a big happiness penalty or something.
We'll say what it should have with some of the religions is some of them should be incompatible. Like, if you have one in your cities, then founding another would either overrides it or you start getting unhappiness and civil war from the two factions fighting each other.
The real problem with this is that Civ uses real-life religions and that would be very controversial.
Well,
that's not real because in the cities of the world today, there's multiple religions running in them.
I would just like to see it be harder to found so many religions oneself.
Besides, I go free religion. I just go free religion as soon as I possibly can.
I don't like it as a civic compared to the other civics if you're just going for a straight what this brings to you. For diplomacy, sometimes it could be hands down the best religious civic just because all the others are going to get you dogpiled. But if you can use organized religion or earlier in the game for a certain point to get a lot of great person points, pacifism, they're usually better. And then, obviously, if you're winning on war, theocracy is going to win out.
It's a blessing and a curse for the AI to have a religion. They have an opportunity cost involved. It doesn't matter if they found a religion, that means they forego getting another tech. Now, if that tech's a military tech, it means you can invade them and take their religion. So it's not necessarily a huge advantage, like the OP in this thread is suggesting. It's just a blessing or a curse, depending on how you use it.
Or depending what's against you.
Yeah, and that too. If the AI manages to get all the religions and they have iron and horses in their BFC, then that's going to be hugely advantageous for them. But if they are weak, even if they have religions, then that's not going to work for them. So it isn't religion itself that plays the crucial part in deciding whether it's advantageous or not.
If they're weak but have a lot of religions which they spread around a lot and they have a lot of strong friends with the same religion, then that can usually make up for it.
That's a valid strategy for them to follow.
To a point. There's not much they can do if they help them if half the cities are captured, and the military power, quite often the human, has enough to beat off all the AIs anyway.
Yeah, but all at once.
I'm actually thinking that maybe the game should be redesigned so espionage and religion would have a bit more synergy. If I remember right, if you have a lot of espionage points on someone, they can declare war on you.
I don't think you need a lot. You just need any in like a random event in industrialism, I think.
Oh.
The person who gets the event allows them to have you declare on them. So if they have industrialism, it'll make you declare war on them and it'll give them a bunch of tanks.
Yeah, I think I heard that one.
Do any of you guys think that if religion was treated like nationality and not like corporations, that it would make for a more interesting game? You would get like 60% Judaism in a city, 40% Confucianism, instead of just having two little buttons telling you there's Confucianism and Judaism present. I mean, you could then change the civics so they reflect this. Theocracy, you could actually make it so that under theocracy you repress the other religions, and that makes the citizens that have those religions unhappy.
The thing is, I think that that would be exploited because you could just put religions into your cities of people that you didn't like. It wouldn't be a fun feature.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah, but when you first send your missionary, they'd only get 10% in that city, and it would have to grow over time to get more. And if they've got theocracy, you wouldn't even get the 10%.
If it seems similar to the influence religion operation.
Yeah, if they already had theocracy and you sent them a missionary, basically, it would be the equivalent of shooting the missionary the moment they arrived in the city. So...
But you can't spread it with theocracy anyway.
Yeah, but if you sent it to them,
yeah,
then it would get 10% that religion and 90% whatever their current religion is, if assuming they only had one.
Also, I assume buildings could affect the percentage of people with a certain religion.
Perhaps it would be 15% if you had the shrine of that particular religion or something to show your missionaries are more effective. But if they then put theocracy in, that's still 85% of their religion in charge. So they don't get much of a downside to having this little one. In fact, over time, it would certainly get repressed and pushed out.
I was thinking as well, if you have, say, another state religion and you want to spread it around, that could be more difficult. But I suppose you would get a bonus if it was your nation's state religion.
Well, say if it's your current state religion and you're sending it to your current cities, then that'd be, say, another reason for having 15% instead of 10%.
Yeah, well, I think it would be higher because I think there'd be a variety of multipliers and deductors based on the situation of your civ.
What the original poster said was actually at the end about not being able to choose what your state religion is going to be, as in mandatory based on which religion is most popular in your civilization, and I thought that was interesting.
I don't like that.
So many instances in civilization where rulers have had different religions than their people, but it would make for a really interesting gameplay as an option, sort of like turning events off.
Well, if you measured two state religions, like you've got your leader's state religion, which is the one you can change, and you've got your people's most popular religion, which if they are different, then you get an unhappy bonus.
Well, I don't know. What if one religion was like 39% and the other like 37% of your population? Then it wouldn't really make sense to only have the penalty for the 39 religion.
Religion should never punish you, period.
Well, it already does that.
How so?
When you declare war on someone with the same religion. So it does punish you to have a religion.
But it doesn't punish you. It just takes away the penalty because you get one happy face for the religion and then you get a minus one for declaring on the same person of the war.
Well, that's punishment.
It's not a penalty, it's just taking away a benefit.
But they should punish you, because the fact they don't, that's why you've got these AIs and other players running away with loads and loads of religions and becoming so powerful.
The opening poster, Sherbs, he's asked, essentially, what is your rationale for this? Quote, the human has an unfair advantage in that they can choose to adopt a minority religion or forego religion altogether for a time. It would be better to remove this choice. If someone wants to convert away, then they have to make an initial hammer investment and spend a period of time in the other religion first. This would make diplomacy far more interesting, in my opinion, unquote. And I think a lot of that comes down to the AI choices in terms of whether or not to be in a state religion, what that state religion is, and the time of it. My view is, rather than removing this choice from the player, let's look at helping the AI make the better choices.
Exactly.
Now, admittedly, I'm not a programmer, so you could say, well, that's going to involve some more work, but I think the end result would be better, because then the AI has the same choice that you have, which is a strategic one, as opposed to removing the strategy altogether in terms of a human choice.
If we wanted a perfect AI, we could always play tic-tac-toe, right?
The one thing that he did say that I thought was unusual later on in the post, Sherbs, who started the thread, when one of your cities converts to religion, this forces your empire to convert to that religion, whether you want to or not. Then your religion is dictated by whichever religion is more numerous in your empire in the future. This could provoke anarchy, or it could not, unquote.
How exactly would this work with freedom of religion? Wouldn't people just then always use freedom of religion instead of being forced to accept...
Well, it would certainly give more benefit to freedom of religion than just it removes diplomatic weaknesses.
You get the tech rate and the extra happiness, too.
That would still be its strongest draw, because if you are forced to convert to your most numerous religion, you would have some incentive to self-spread a religion around your cities using your own missionaries, but if you have one of those zealous AIs, they'll probably do that for you anyway, in which case, that's one of the situations where you can actually run a religion.
I was wondering, do we actually even need missionary units? Why couldn't we just link it to, let's say, culture spending or something like that and eliminate it?
Well, at first they were not going to have missionaries in the game at all, which they decided was a bad idea. I mean, the thing about taking away control from the player, it's generally bad.
Well, yeah, I agree with that, but...
And that's why I think switching religions automatically is bad too, because it takes control away from the player, which is kind of iffy.
The player doesn't like that. You're right about that. Espionage could actually play a role in state repression of religion. We have theocracy, right, where it's impossible to spread religion. I was just thinking, you have so much on spies in the ancient times. Let's say high espionage rating would let you reduce the chances of success for foreign missionaries and improve the chances of success of your own missionaries. Thus, it would kind of force the player, if he wanted to get rid of foreign religions, to invest a lot into espionage. In my own experience, espionage still doesn't work quite right.
Well, so you could argue that, say, if you've got theocracy, that gives you the option of an extra espionage mission. So you send your spies in, and they can do an inquisition and root out religion.
Exactly, purge the other religion.
Yeah.
It's not really a spy thing, that would be more of a reverse missionary. I mean, inquisitors are in a mod, I think, of Civ.
Yeah.
It can't be too complicated either.
You could, for simplicity, add it as a spy mission, or even a missionary mission.
The original Civ 4 manual, if I remember right, they already intended to have religion be treated the same way as nationality, and they decided to change that.
Religion's something I don't particularly care about. I just like go, yeah, yeah, let's get free religion ASAP, because I hate it.
I actually ignore religion, too, in my games.
And plus, it's very hard to balance.
I think it should be made stronger, in a way.
I hate the bias and the nasty things that religion has caused over the years.
You do realize you're playing Civilization, right? AIs need the rationality for war, and, well, everyone likes a good war, doesn't they?
I am playing Civilization. I like to run my Civilization as I please.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. You just said you don't like things dividing you.
If you want a rationality for declaring war, just play a game with Dan Q.
And if you want the AI to have rationality for war, just play with Shaka.
Talking about excuses to get each other killed, I really liked how Smack did it with ideologies. It's a lot more interesting than the way it's handled in Civ 4. Oh, that's basically the second topic, isn't it? About a least favorite civic.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, yeah.
An idea. The least favorite civic. Started by the poster Ziamat. His line of thought in the first post is that you should incur a diplomatic penalty for running a certain civic, similar to the civic bonus that you get for running a favorite civic, or religious hatred for running an opposite religion of the AI. Basically, each AI would have a civic that it actually dislikes actively, in that if you run it, then it dislikes you. He also came up with the idea where if you have a leader that you run your own most hated civic in, then you get a happiness penalty in all your cities.
So if you're playing as, say, Mao, and you choose free religion, for example.
His least favorite civic might be serfdom.
Yeah, serfdom.
Serfdom sucks enough already. Don't attack serfdom more.
Well,
it's like the worst civic in the game, other than the basic ones.
That's basically the real problem with this idea.
But somebody suggested that Justinian, his least favorite civic would be paganism, and you're just kind of like, well, come on. It's not like paganism had any tooth anyway.
That's what I wanted to say. The biggest problem is the civics aren't balanced as they are, and the AI doesn't know how to use civics very well. It took Blake to mod the AI to teach it how to use state property when it's most efficient. I suppose it would be a lot of work balancing this all out, but this can be said for practically any feature in Civ, and I think it's a good idea overall. It was really, really fun when Chairman Yang berating you and telling you how democracy is the cousin of anarchy.
The thing I find, though, is that there's enough already in the game that punishes you diplomatically. I'm all for more punishment, but there has to be more benefits, too.
Yeah.
There has to be more that makes your people happy and things that make diplomacy easier.
You could even have leaders having a favourite other leader, so they automatically like you just because you're shiny.
Well, the AI already has that.
That happens, except for humans.
Well, no, whatever leader you pick as. If you're playing as Churchill and the AI is Roosevelt, vice versa, they like you just because you're you, and things like that.
I don't really like that idea.
I feel like the downside of being a least favorite, it could just be only seeing the diplomatic bonus you get with having a favorite.
There's also a severe problem here when this least favorite civic happens to be an optimal civic for the AI. For example, somebody hating slavery.
Yeah, Lincoln.
Now, would the AI still run slavery and then suck, like, -2 or -3 in happiness?
Lincoln would be a terrible leader if he had a penalty for running slavery. Given, slavery is very imbalanced.
What if we only make this a factor once they reach the industrial era?
Well, then it wouldn't have much impact on any game.
Well, it could vary from leader to leader as to where it comes in. Like, to begin with Lincoln, he likes slavery. Then after a certain point, like industrial era, he doesn't like it.
Maybe he wants emancipations researched.
Yeah, that makes it functionally irrelevant, because if he doesn't care about slavery until emancipation, pretty much every AI I've ever seen in this game will go emancipation once it can do so, to the point where it's actually obnoxious because it doesn't actually benefit all the AIs that do it.
True. I was actually thinking maybe the least favorite civic mechanic could work if there were more effects in civics that depended on how many civs use the civic. Let's say with free market, I think you get an extra trade route in the city, right? And that extra trade route is often more profitable if you have it to a bigger city of a foreign civ. So if that foreign civ is running free market, you get more commerce, you get more profit, right? Emancipation is a bad example of that because it punishes players who don't use it. And when everyone uses it, like you pointed out, there's no benefit to it. It's basically a vampire civic.
I still like it, though.
Unless you're still growing cottages.
The other thing that the original poster said about running the least favorite civic being penalized by having more unhappy faces, particularly in the case of Lincoln, would just blink. Definitely just slavery early on. Makes it cool if you have to go directly to Casta. I don't know how you would be able to win.
I'm actually thinking here that maybe if we kept it just a diplomacy penalty.
Yeah, I think so too.
It wouldn't really change the game that much, because I don't ever remember playing a game where someone was my enemy simply because I didn't accept hereditary rule or something like that. So if the case is the opposite, I think you can still be good friends with someone with a civ, let's say with Stalin, and you just happen to disagree on free market.
In some respects, the game does already have a penalty for not having their favorite civic.
Exactly.
If they ask you to change and you say no, then you'll get a penalty already. That's already getting a penalty for not picking their favorite civic, so another penalty on top of that for picking their least favorite.
But there's a difference, you see, because let's say someone could absolutely loathe environmentalism, but still their favorite civic would be like universal suffrage or something like that.
And they'd still run environmentalism, because that's how the AI is right now. It really annoys me. Even like AIs like Stalin will run environmentalism rather than state property. Or someone who loves hereditary rule goes to universal suffrage instantly. And it's a big problem for, like, say, Bismarck with AIs that use nationhood, favorite civic, sorry. And they're basically never in it. Like, the AI is coded to draft offensively and defensively, and it won't do it because it never actually runs nationhood.
I was actually thinking about something. Couldn't you do some rather clever things by balancing both unique units, unique buildings, generally civ traits, and the favorite and least favorite civic for an AI? Could start with just listing all possible combinations of favorite and least favorite civic, identifying viable strategies, and just then civs with suboptimal strategies would just get better unique units and unique buildings to compensate that.
There's no need to balance it, because there's some extremely broken and imbalanced civs, and some really terrible ones.
Okay, that's true.
Having listened to both the arguments for either having or not introducing a least favorite civic, and then concerns over the even favorite civic that we have right now, rather than designating a favorite civic for a civilization or introducing a least favorite civic, have it so that the AI is taking into account their particular game circumstances, decide which one is best for them. If you happen to be running one of the civics that they are running, then you get a diplomatic bonus for that. Perhaps you get a diplomatic negative modifier if you are not running whatever their civic happens to be in that particular point in time.
I was actually thinking, why not just make the AI selfish? Let them hate you for running a civic that is bad for them that you're running. let's make civs hate you for running mercantilism if they're running free market, etc.
You would have to actually let the AI be capable then of determining what civics are good for it and which of your civics are good for it. That hasn't happened consistently even now.
Well, you could have a basic lookup table there. As you said, you've got one civ running slavery, another one runs emancipation. That already is in the game.
Yeah.
Copying that mechanic to other civic combinations is what he's talking about.
Exactly. Free market and mercantilism is a good example. There's no possible way running mercantilism could be good for your civ. If your friend's running mercantilism and you're running free market, that can be good for you.
That's true.
There is one thing as well. Historically, when people were having ideas about democratic governments, the hereditary rule people hated it. They were scared that they would lose all their power. So naturally, nations that would be in democratic types of government might receive hate from the hereditary rule monarchs.
Be careful here. In Civ 4, representation and universal suffrage also represent constitutional monarchies.
Constitutional monarchies are a different story.
I don't know if it's really wise to implement that in Civ. I know they're different, but in practice, let's say Great Britain during the time of revolutionary France was, well, there were many democratic systems present already.
Yeah, there was.
It might be better for the penalty to be administered through anarchy. If you're switching to your least favorite civic, have a few extra turns of anarchy because they're just so unhappy with this new form of government.
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea.
Yeah, so you don't get the long-term penalty because people might actually decide to get used to it and think, actually, we don't like it, but it works.
Actually, switching to your favorite civic could be like a mini-spiritual trait. You could get no anarchy for switching to your favorite civic.
Yeah, that might be nice. I like that.
That's actually not bad. I think for every punishment, there should be a reverse benefit.
I just don't think that the idea of using unhappy faces to penalize least favorite civic is going to work, because you don't get happy faces for running whatever favorite civic. People don't say, we love having hereditary rule or whatever. It's the leader's favorite civic.
Using happy and angry faces to penalize or reward the players shows a kind of lack of imagination, to be honest. It's the first idea you get.
Even so, like I keep saying, there's enough in there to penalize the human player in particular.
Well, yeah, but the idea Lisa talked about is...
Yeah, it's not bad.
Well, it would make a very fun game, to be honest.
You're thinking about negating it, too.
But then what would happen for a spiritual civ, you know, switching to their favorite religion? Would you get, like, one free turn of Golden Age or something? That'd be cool.
No, I think you could do it so that spiritual civs wouldn't get a penalty for switching to their least favorite civic.
Oh, yeah.
That would make it stronger. You see, it balances itself out.
It means that the spiritual doesn't really gain anything out of that deal.
Actually, it would. Let's say your least favorite civic is a really useful civic and you would normally suffer a lot of anarchy for it, but because you're spiritual, you don't suffer any anarchy for it. So spiritual civs could basically, for their own purposes, ignore their favorite and least favorite civic.
Oh, so you're saying they get the benefit but not the drawback? Like as in, if they switch to a favorite civic, they get the bonus, but they don't...
Exactly.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, say they don't have to suffer anarchy anyways, so they don't get the bonus for changing to their favorite civic... But then again, they don't get the drawback for changing to their least favorite either.
Well,
You can just sit and go, change.
Maybe spiritual should be renamed pragmatic.
Or they could be flip-flops.
Right.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but may be in the future.
Siege as attachments. In atypical fashion on Polycast, rather than saying this thread was started by so-and-so and he or she said this, we can actually have the person who started this thread say what it is they said.
Sorry, you have to introduce this. You don't get a choice. Just FYI.
If I can remember it by now. Okay, well, this thread is by the illustrious poster Kamikaze, and it's entitled Siege's Attachments.
Is that why you named yourself Kamikaze? Because it was in praise of this poster?
Oh, absolutely. He's been my hero for a while now. This thread is about using Siege's attachments as opposed to individual units as they currently are in the game. So, as the opening poster, Kamikaze, i.e. me, says, Siege are built as per in Civ 4, but do not represent the same type of unit as in Civ 4. They're meant to be attachments, they're meant to be attached to a standard unit, and then they can be used as a move for that unit. This should reduce their power. We all know they're overpowered as they are in the game. They can be thrown away. They're expendable. Make them more useful in bombarding other units instead of simply reducing them through collateral damage. And overall, it should really reduce their effectiveness, which probably should be a good thing. Reducing stacks as well reduces the power of stacks. And it also should allow for the greater cost of siege to be taken into account by the player.
So basically you're saying treat them like a bit like great generals in the fact that they can be attached to units.
Yeah, precisely.
Not a bad idea.
It's not bad.
Interesting. Kamikaze, can I just ask you in one sentence, what do you think is the primary advantage of this system? Really, is it worth the extra complexity?
Reducing the power of siege.
Well, there are several other ways you could go about doing that.
Yes, this one seems to me to be more realistic.
I don't really like this idea where you write, when an infantry with an artillery attachment is adjacent to an enemy city, the infantry can use it to bombard the city. Did you actually meant to cause damage to units?
I'm of the preference that we bring back bombarding of units as well, instead of having artillery specifically attack, which isn't really a realistic representation of what they can do.
That's true.
I wouldn't so much say bombard a specific unit, more you bombard a tile and any
the
units
stack.
Get splatted. Yeah.
Yeah, bombard the stack.
You bombard a tile and it doesn't matter whether there's a city in it, a unit in it.
Or a bunch of units.
Improvements, they all just get flattened.
You could just bombard them and everything would happen at once, you're saying. So you get like a certain percentage of city defense lowered.
Well, the thing is, when you're attacking, it's always bombard, but you're bombarding the tile. It doesn't matter what's in it. The damage is then calculated based on units might be defended by the city until it's down to a certain percentage of strength. Then they start taking damage. But you can bombard outside the city and the units will take damage and tile improvements will take damage and things like that.
So let's say bombarding a single unit infantry wouldn't really do much for you, but bombarding 10 units of infantry would be really hurtful. Basically, that's even realistic.
I don't think that this would necessarily nerf siege at all.
No, you could nerf it by...
And you would still have the problem with the defender having initiative with the bombardment and just railing the offensive stacks for a collateral before the offensive stacks could respond to it.
There's one big conceptual difference. If you can bombard units, let's say if you could bombard units without attacking them, the cap on damage that you can cause with siege becomes, well, less annoying.
This all presupposes that siege units are currently overpowered. And I think definitely in the case of multiplayer, they can be. But it's not really that much of a problem with the AI, or at least in my experience, it hasn't.
Partly because the AI is not that smart, and that's the primary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the primary thing. It's really not necessary against the AI on low levels where it can't match your production by getting 50% off of all its units. Whereas on high level, siege becomes mandatory to have any chance, or a tech lead or some other advantage, like getting to them before they can actually take advantage of their production boosts. But generally, late game stack warfare against AI, just to overcome its hammer bonuses, you need to inflict a lot of collateral on it. And that makes siege mandatory.
Kamikaze, do you currently feel that they're overpowered? I mean, that's why you made the post, right?
Well, they're mainly overpowered in attack, I reckon. You have stacks, you have a lot of siege in stacks, and you can go to any city and basically wear the defenses right down. Longbowmen, city garrison 2, that's no problem if you have a couple of catapults with you.
Instead of actually having it as you bombard a unit, cause damage, I was just thinking like a couple of other games treat siege, Total War. Siege, what it means is, actually, you don't use it to attack the city. What it does, it allows you to effectively surround the city and slowly just wear it down. You don't bombard it, you just sit there and just go, the units just sort of lose health as they run out of food and...
That's actually something that's bothered me in Civ for quite some time, that they don't have it. But maybe we could do it in a similar manner, like naval units have the ability to blockade, land blockade.
You're blockading around a city.
Yeah.
And you basically say, look, you can't get out, you can't get in, your trade is cut off, your food starts running out.
You can't wear blockaded titles.
The game mechanics would have to change, because if you're blockading on land, or even if you're going for pillaging, you're not capturing cities and you're not expediting the war. And the penalty for staying at war with somebody is very severe in this game. as is. I mean, people tech away from you. Now, a lot of the AIs are much more likely to declare on you. Well, pretty much every AI is more likely to declare on you if you're at war with somebody already, and gives the target a chance to build more units in all the other cities. So there's really not much benefit to going on blockading or pillage sprees in this game, other than the fact that if you blockade with, like, privateers, it causes the AI to spam units it normally wouldn't that hurt it.
But we were talking about land blockades here.
Well, I know, but...
You could literally starve the city out.
If you're land blockading, that means you are at war, and sure, you're starving one city, but unless the game mechanics are changed, the penalty for doing that is so severe it isn't worth it. Well, almost without exception.
Stuart also assumed that the city defense would go down the more turns the city was blockaded.
Because the defenders would be running out of food, getting ill, and...
Well, it's also realistic as is. I mean, soldiers don't live 6,000 years. I think that's a basic aspect of a lot of gameplay, that it's irrelevant that people eat and people sleep.
I actually think it would be very fun, Stuart's idea. Think about it. How interesting is that? You blockade a city, taking away basically all its cultural defense bonuses, but keeping the physical defenses intact. That would add a bit of strategy. It would boost the non-cultural defenses you can build, because sieges can't take those away.
What about laying siege to a city that happens to be building a wonder that you're trying to build? You want to build the wonder, so you lay siege to them. They can't build that wonder whilst it's under siege.
I would not mind siege having an impact on what the city adjacent to, or even units having an impact on the city they're adjacent to, and cutting into their production. That makes sense, and it does give some incentive for the defenders to attack, although there's plenty with siege already. But it would take away some of the unbelievable circumstances of just magically generating a ton of units in the defending city while the siege is on the outside of it.
Exactly.
I really hate when that happens. Really, the AI just moves a couple units in from nowhere, whips out like 2 longbows or 4 longbows in the time it takes for you to just bombard the city down, and then you're attacking 15 units in the city instead of like 4.
Unattached siege units. They'd be just non-functional because otherwise be inclined to just not attach them at all.
I thought they'd basically be like pieces of machinery. They have no one to operate them. That's what the standard unit that they're attached to does. They fulfill the role of the operator of the machinery.
So they have no defensive power?
No, they're basically like workers.
Oh, I see.
So 50% chance that it's captured, 50% chance that it's destroyed?
Yeah.
Once the parent unit has died.
Maybe even have a promotion where if a unit has this promotion, the artillery is always destroyed and never captured by foreign forces.
What, like a scuttle promotion?
Yeah, exactly. It was used pretty much in World War II. I mean, you had Leningrad, Stalingrad, even Moscow for a while.
Siege has been prominent in warfare since cannons.
I think it might be interesting if the power of the siege weapon were corresponded to the power of the person operating it. You could have, like, siege scale, like, specific promotions for team together units.
Well, you could have a bit of combination, really. You have a warrior with a cannon. Well, do a hell of a lot better than a warrior with a catapult. But if you upgraded that to an infantryman, then he'd be better trained, and he could use the catapult just as well.
Maybe a better way to do this would be, let's say, simple units, like a warrior with a cannon, is just as good as an infantry with a cannon. But when you attack that warrior, well, the warrior has practically nil chances of scuttling the cannon, so your enemy takes it.
Is wearing a loincloth and fire cannon.
I was thinking more, a warrior with a cannon is going to be better than a warrior with a catapult, but an infantryman with a catapult will easily be better, just because he's better trained, than a warrior with a cannon. So a better unit with a lesser equipment will still do better than a crap unit with brilliant equipment.
I don't know about that. I would much rather see some advanced trained like troop from nowadays using a catapult aimed in my general direction than anybody pointing a cannon at me.
Why don't we just limit units to which cannons and catapults can be drafted on? I mean, you can use a catapult with ancient and medieval and Renaissance units, but you can't use it with modern and industrial units.
Well, you could make that limit by just simply obsoleting the different types of siege unit.
Exactly.
Just to bring this conversation back full, siege being the separate and independent units, having read your suggestion, Kamikaze, and also hearing the subsequent discussion, my opinion hasn't changed. There are certain things from what you have said that I would like to extract and take into the game, but going back to the original question about whether they should be attachments or separate and independent units, I still think siege units should be separate units. Towards a diversification of your army, the need for offense, or perhaps if you just want it for offense, and also can be wanted for defense if not even needed. I think a lot of the time when we get into a siege discussion, we're talking about the offensive part, but it also has defensive benefit as well if you so choose to use it that way. But I do like the discussion with regards to siege units being used as a land blockade. Given the strength of this, the need to have it surrounded by a city, just giving another reason for the city that's surrounded by siege units to get rid of them, because there still is enough reason now to be able to get rid of siege units. Whether that affects your production or not, well, it would. If that city was no longer had access to iron, for instance, and you're in the ancient era, then no more swordsmen for you in that particular city. The part where you have about the unscorted siege units having a chance to be captured, I like that idea. It's been compared to the ability of capturing unescorted workers. The difference I see between siege and workers is, of course, that workers are non-combat units and siege units are. So it wouldn't be, yes, you automatically capture that siege unit if it was unescorted. Either a 50-50 chance, perhaps, as also been suggested, improve the odds of either it being captured or it being destroyed even through promotions, whether it be scuttle, like, oh, if my siege unit gets by itself, then I want to lessen the chance that my enemy's going to be able to capture that scuttle, or you could improve a particular offensive unit you have to be able to capture unescorted units.
I'd add one thing about if they're not attached to anything or they're unescorted, they can't move because there's no one there to move them.
That's a good idea.
Well, typically an artillery crew would be trained with people who would be trained to fire the weapon.
That's true.
Yeah, so I always considered them a part of the unit, even though you didn't visually see them necessarily. That was implied that the unit was people specifically trained for the use of the siege unit. They couldn't do any other combat, right? They couldn't do anything else except control that particular unit.
Typically, if cavalry got up close to catapults, it was a disaster, because the sidearms that the catapult or cannon men had were of no match against men on horses with sabers. It'd just be, oh, let's make a mess.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to Polycast episode 83, here with your regular co-hosts, the Me and Team.
Binary researching animal husbandry and nukes.
Thank you.
The zoo is now closed for today.
And co-hosts, Petrox.
Bye.
QNL.
This subway smells like a potty.
Heraclitus.
The blood of my enemies keeps me young.
MMC.
Goodbye.
And myself, Kamikaze.
Well, I was just thinking...
Whoa.
Well, you're repeating yourself there, Lisa.
Snizzamits, snizzamits, snizzamits,
snizzamits. That doesn't sound good.
Okay, wait. Normal now.
Oh, dear. What's happening there?
Sorry. Okay, wait a second. Is this working now?
Yeah, you got looping audio there, Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa, I don't know if you're able to hear us all right, but you're doing what is affectionately referred to as the Mackie round.
What was it?
How big's your MP3 that you've got to upload, Lisa?
Another hour and a half.
Sorry, that's ridiculous.
Is it looping again? Looping again?
Yes, it's looping again.
And again, and again, and again.
Okay. Seriously?
That was a serious rap, Lisa.
Perhaps you should just type how big it is.
Record date?
November 28th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword, sound, clips, copyright, Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009. Civilized Communication at civcom.net.